Otto Weininger is arguably the most sexist man of all time. And yet he was hailed as a genius by none other than Ludwig Wittgenstein, Sigmund Freud. He was admired by Franz Kafka, by James Joyce, by Strindberg, and many, many other luminaries of the early 20th century. His book, Sex and Character, was a smash hit and caused a sensation when it came out in 1902, 1903, went all around Europe, especially in Vienna, where he lived. It was a sensation. However, it was also immediately controversial for all sorts of reasons. It was particularly loathed passionately by the feminists of his time. It has continued to be hated by feminists all through the ages, right up until the modern day. And yet, it's the book that seems to never go away. Now, before I discuss this, there's a number of things that I think is worth getting out of the way before we get on to Weininger's ideas proper. The first is that Weininger himself clearly had some personal issues. Sigmund Freud said that even though there's a touch of genius in Weininger, clearly there's a lot of neuroticism and pathology as well, and clearly he was kind of mentally unstable in some way. I say that because moments after the book was published, Weininger committed suicide at the age of 23. And many people have thought that what he talks about in the book, which is masculinity and femininity and sex differences and the difference between men and women, was something that he struggled with personally. Namely, that he saw feminine qualities in himself. This was unacceptable to his own kind of framework that we're going to talk through. And so he ended up paying the ultimate price for it. This added to the sense of sensation and scandal around the book when it came out. But it's also something that has interested scholars looking back on Weininger. But here's the important thing here. That does not mean that we can dismiss his work, right? Just because he committed suicide and just because he was mentally unstable himself does not mean that he wasn't raising some salient points. And given that one of his arguments in this book pertains to rationality in the masculine type versus emotionalism in the feminine type, I found it interesting. I was kind of interested to see if over the past 120 years, if there had ever been a serious, sustained, rational, calm, measured and reasoned attempt to argue against any of the points that Weininger made. Or was he simply met with frothing at the mouth with emotion? And ironically, basically he was met with frothing at the mouth at the time, and he has been met with frothing at the mouth even up to the present day, which to me suggests that there's obviously something to what he was saying, right? There's obviously something there because they've been unable to produce facts, logic, evidence against the points that he's raising. And I'm actually reminded of a tweet that I, back when I was on Twitter, before I made my life better by deleting it. You should all delete Twitter, by the way. I made a kind of little joke. It was a tweet that went around the world. I said, the average height of women is 5'4". Yes, but I'm 5'8", though. This is all arguments with women. Okay, that was my tweet. Now, that tweet got tens and thousands of likes, and it went all around the world. And in fact, it became memed, and I've seen that variations upon that tweet turn up in meme form where, you know, it's not even attributed to me anymore. It's just kind of taken on a life of its own, as memes do. And the reason that it resonated with so many people is because they recognize the situation. What is the basic problem there? It is the inability to get your personal or emotional immediate response out of the way and recognize the aggregate statistic, the average, okay, the average as opposed to the specific example. So the fact that you're 5'8" is neither here nor there. The important statistic is, on average, women are 5'4". Okay, that is the average height for women. Your individual case is neither here nor there, because we're talking in the aggregate. And this is something that many, many people struggle with. Per capita is another one as well. And in microcosm, this little meme of mine basically sums up a lot of what Weininger is saying, and indeed the reception that he had at the time and that he has had since. So that is a long preamble to, in some sense, explain why I've put Weininger on my Great Thinkers series. Was he perfect as an individual? No. Do I agree with all the things that he said? No. But does he remain provocative? Does he remain prescient? Why does this book keep on coming up again and again? Why does modernity struggle with a figure like Weininger so much? Why was he praised in his own lifetime by people who are considered geniuses in their own right, like Freud and Wittgenstein and Joyce and all of these other people who were around at the time, Kafka? All of these questions and more I want to explore in this time. And I also want to kind of challenge people to really think about some of the things that he's saying and whether you have the capacity to deal with the aggregate versus the emotional response. There is an argument to say that this issue, the issue of sex and character, which Weininger talk about, it has become the issue of our age, or one of the most prescient issues of our age, as feminism has become ever more, let's just say, in alignment with power and the official state ideology. And people keep on pointing out the things that Weininger pointed out 120 years ago. So the issue doesn't go away. And in fact, the more people kind of shriek, the louder, in a way, the talking points from Weininger gets. So I think that we should not shrink away from reading a book and taking a book like Sex and Character by Weininger seriously, okay? If you're going to call yourself intellectual or academic, you have to have the capacity to be able to confront a provocative text like Weininger's and take it on its own terms and take each argument as it comes. So that is my challenge to you, especially if you're watching this video coming from the left. There'll also be all sorts of people who watch this video who find themselves in agreement with Weininger. So that's my very long intro. This is what Weininger looks like. We're going to get to these 10 points. First of all, though, it is still July here, just about a couple of days left on my summer sale. If you want to take advantage of it, it's promo code Scorcher. Time is running out. There won't be another sale. I think, top of my head, the next sale comes around Halloween time. It's usually like bonfire night when I do my next sale. So this is the last chance for quite a while to take advantage, to get a discount on the sale. Buy it now. And when we come back, we're going to talk about Weininger. It's the Academic Agency Summer Sale. Use the promo code SCORCHER. 25% off all courses. SCORCHER. Get it now. SCORCHER. 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 Promo code SCORCHER. 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 Buy it now. All right, so let's get back to Weininger. I basically, this is just a slide saying all the stuff I just said in the intro. But let's get on to his first big idea here. He talks in Sex and Character about two archetypal principles, the masculine principle and the feminine principle. Now, bear in mind, he is talking here about principles in the abstract, not actual men and women. And this is important to really understanding Weininger's work, okay? He is talking, in essence, about a particular spirit, you might say. So the masculine principle is one of form, of logic, of universality, of genius, of morality, of transcendence, and the autonomous world-building self. Whereas the feminine principle, according to Weininger, is about matter and material concerns, practical material concerns, sexuality, and the particular. It is about emotion, it is about immanence, relatedness, and the embedded relational self. Now, these are metaphysical and psychological archetypes present in varying measure in every human being, extending far beyond merely biological categories. Now, this is one of those areas where, you know, if you come into this, if you're watching this video, for example, from the left, and you've only come across Weininger in a kind of gender studies, the feminist rant or something like this, you're going to miss the fact that Weininger actually says, well, the thing is, these are principles. So you can, in theory, get a woman who embodies the masculine principle. And you can, in theory, get a man who embodies the feminine principle. Everybody has got some masculine in them and some feminine in them. Okay. Now, it just so happens that most men will lean towards the masculine. I say most, maybe that's not true so much in current year. In fact, Weininger said that even in his own time, there were lots of men who did fail to kind of embody the masculine principle, okay? But there can also be women who embody the masculine principle. And there can be men who embody the feminine principle. So he does say there's a mix of both, right? But on average, remember, the average height of women is 5'4". On average, most men will be more towards the masculine and most women will be more towards the feminine. Okay? He says that every person contains both principles in varying proportions. Many men are more or less spiritual women. And some women are spiritual men. However, on average, the great majority of men embody, well, the great majority of women embody the feminine principle far more strongly than the masculine. And the existence of exceptions, so yeah, there you can have mannish women, right? And you can have womanly men, okay? But the very fact that there are these exceptions to the rule does not abolish the reality of the average. And this distinction is something that the critics of Weininger persistently ignore. Okay, you cannot take the exception to the rule, okay, to prove that the rule does not exist. Okay. Because that is the same as, oh, well, I'm 5'8", though. All right, well, that just means that not all average doesn't mean everybody. It just means in general. Okay, and in this case, it's not even an average. It is just the majority. In this case, we're talking about an outlier versus most. Okay? Now, this is where things get a little bit more controversial, because Otto Weininger argued that genius is almost exclusively masculine. The capacity for original, universal, system-building thought, philosophical works, belongs almost exclusively to the masculine principle. For Weininger, the highest achievement in philosophy, art, science, religion, have been produced by those in whom M, that's the masculine principle, strongly predominates. This is a metaphysical necessity rooted in the nature of the principles themselves and not a cultural accident. Now, looking at that and saying, well, okay, well, if you say on average, most men have got more masculine and most women have got more feminine. And then if you think, well, in both cases, so yeah, you get those outliers, the womanly men and the manly women. They are extreme outliers. But also within each spectrum, you get the extreme outliers, like the extreme masculine. Okay, so that is somebody who really over-indexes in the masculine principle. And then you get women who really over-index in the feminine principle. And what Weininger is saying is for, you know, these people who produce world changing, you know, what is called genius, paradigm shifting philosophies, ideas, inventions, you know, scientific works, artistic works, etc. They're tapping into something universal and abstract. And in order to get to that universal and abstract, you have to look beyond yourself and your immediate material needs, your immediate material circumstances. Okay, you have to, in effect, transcend your quote-unquote lower self in order to get to these abstract universal truths. And what he's saying is that if you have a high femininity principle within yourself, you struggle to get beyond your own personal experiences, your own personal wants and needs, your own kind of particular circumstances. Remember, I'm 5'8" though. But yeah, it doesn't matter because we're talking about the average. We're just making a statement of fact. Well, it's the same principle now, but we're talking about whatever it is, quantum physics, whatever else, okay? And what Weininger argues is that on average, look, on average, most men aren't going to achieve genius either, right? But those ones who do are the ones who are able to get beyond kind of mere material concerns. They tap into something higher. Whereas in Weininger's observation, and by his time, there had been feminism for a while, and there had been female writers, and there had been even female philosophers, but they tended to exclusively write about personal relationships or their own experiences or themselves. Now, this is kind of interesting because now we have 120 years worth of data added on to what Weininger was saying. And if you have a look, again, you know, you could probably think of one or two exceptions. Okay, you could probably think of one or two exceptions to this. But generally speaking, a lot of the female philosophers have tended to write about quote-unquote women's issues or things that are personal to them, or you know, they tend to look at the particular as opposed to the big universal abstract system. There is no female Immanuel Kant. Now you could say, well, there'll be sexism, racism, but there's actually nothing, there has been nothing stopping there being a female Immanuel Kant. But they have chosen, okay, you think about it this way. You could say, yes, there has been misogyny and you know, barriers stopping women for 2,000 years. Let's just grant feminists that. Say, well, the patriarchal culture kept women down, yada, yada, yada. But then think, well, since, you know, 120 years since then, women have been given the microphone, gave the woman the microphone. What are you going to say? Okay, what are you going to say for yourself? What's your great work of ethics or philosophy here? And then they tended to talk exclusively about themselves or about their own immediate concerns or about, you know, like I said, things that are particular to them, not abstract universal principles. And this is a difference, a fundamental difference in masculine and feminine thinking that Weininger is trying to get at. He's not saying that women are completely incapable of this because of the outlier, but he's saying that if you're high in that femininity principle, you're going to struggle to do the abstract universal reasoning thing. And it's those things that are abstract universal reasoning that tend to be hailed as genius, because they're able to gain insight to logic and reason and evidence. And you see, for this reason, people often wonder, well, why does feminism have such a problem with quote unquote patriarchal modes of thinking, logic, evidence, the demand for evidence and reason, the demand for absolute standards? Why does it want to try to relativize these and say, well, actually, these are just constructions as well? Well, one argument to say is that because they want the ground to be particular, they want the ground to be relativistic, and they want the ground to be emotional and in terms of, quote, lived experience. In other words, they're trying to move, in Weininger's terms, from the masculine principle to the feminine principle, hence feminism. So it's kind of funny, because the responses that feminism has in its way generated against the essentialism of Weininger ends up reproducing the exact thing that he talks about. They're just arguing in favor of it. They're just arguing in favor of his feminine principle and against the masculine principle. Weininger argues that women are primarily sexual. In his system, the pure feminine type is defined by sexuality. A woman's existence is more completely absorbed by the sexual function, according to Weininger, as a mother, for example, or as an erotic being, than a man's ever is. Okay? And again, it's easy to say, well, this is just a kind of this is just chauvinism. Is it though? Because again, if you pick up any feminist studies, they're always talking about their bodies. Women are more intimately connected with their bodies. They feel closer to their bodies on average than people who are high in the these masculine principles, because the masculine principle is all about abstraction. It's all about actually, you know, getting beyond the material world to these universal things that Weininger is talking about. Whereas, of course, there's nothing more particular than the body. So again, it stands to reason that if feminism is a revolt against the masculine principle and an argument for the feminine principle to predominate in a culture, that they would also revolt against, you know, rationality and things like that, but also that they would champion closeness to the body, and that they would champion materialism. And you see how things have gone. You can see how things have gone in the past. We do live in a culture that likes to talk about bodies a lot, and also we live in a very materialist culture as well, an ever more materialist culture. Weininger frames this as a metaphysical claim about essential orientation rather than a moral accusation. Okay, he is not saying, Weininger, that the feminine is wicked, right, or that women are evil. He is saying that they are not fully orientated towards the transcendent in the way that his ideal masculine principles are. He's also not saying, by the way, that most men achieve that, what he's talking about either. He's talking about these, you know, it's a spectrum. And you can start to see how, as I'm talking through all of this, that so much of our current gender discourse and so much of the stuff that you find in modern day kind of gender theory and so on is already there. in a book like this by Weininger, and that whether they realize it or not, they are in some sense of dialogue with something, with a thinker that they think abhorrent, and that they in many cases won't even acknowledge or even be aware of. He says emotionality has a strength for women, but it is also a limitation. Women's greater emotionality, or I should say the feminine principle's greater emotionality and relational sensitivity, constitute genuine strengths in empathy, in nurturing, in personal care, and in the concrete human sphere, domains of irreplaceable cultural value. Okay, so if a society didn't have any of those kind of classical feminine traits or strengths, okay, society probably wouldn't function without those things. However, the feminine mind tends to personalize, it tends to particularize, and it tends to react from feeling rather than from detached first principles. A limitation when abstract, universal, impersonal reasoning is required. And some cases, some fields, some areas of life, some parts of thinking, strategy, for example, do require getting personal, emotional, particular stuff out of the way in the name of some other goal, some higher purpose. And this, traditionally, and indeed, you'd still argue even today, has been the masculine principle. Or, to put it in other terms, the role of the hero, or the role of the man of contemplation. You're not going to get that far in your hero's journey or in your abstract philosophy if you constantly cannot get out of the way of your personal gripes and, petty concerns. You have to leave those at the door. And this whole way of thinking and being, you could say, is something that many people in the modern academy have struggled with in their writing, in their work, because. You know, I wrote a whole paper on in defense of value-free analysis, right? Value-free analysis. Well, what is value-free analysis? It is the ability to get out of the way of all of these things, of all of the personal, the particular, you know, reacting from feeling, being unable to, having attachment to particular things. You've got to be able to have this kind of detached third-person observer point of view. Sometimes. And sometimes, I mean, it depends on the situation, but sometimes that can be the matter of life and death, you know, in like war strategy, for example, or whatever else, you know. These are some of the reasons why, that, you know, historically they wanted a divide between the sexes in, you know, women in the army, for example. Well, if there are women in the army, they may fall in love with the men in the same division, and that can become a hazard on the battlefield, because if the soldier doesn't keep his eye on the mission and instead is thinking, oh no, she's on the floor, I love her, I have to go, he loses his post, you know, that could get the whole division, that could get the whole army killed in a doomsday scenario, and many things like that. So This is what I'm talking about. And, you know, you could argue that as time has gone on, the modern world has struggled more and more with that way of thinking that says, like, look, we need to leave emotions at the door and, you know, think from first principles here. I would argue that during my lifetime, there has been a decline in the capacity to do that. in general, both men and women. The problem of emancipation. Now, genuine emancipation, Otto Weininger argues, is only possible for the quote-unquote masculine woman, okay? Now, when we're talking about this, he has in mind the feminists of his own time, okay? He has in mind what the feminists were arguing. Like, they were already a live political force in 1902, 1903 when he was writing. So there are women, they do exist in the world, who have a genuinely high proportion of his masculine principle. Okay, now in this country, we think of somebody like, the classic example is Margaret Thatcher, okay? Margaret Thatcher, who was depicted when I was a kid, when she was the prime minister, you know, it's almost like as a kind of thug with, you know, she wore like, in spitting image, she had leather gloves and she pushed, you know, pushed the men up against the wall because she was seen as like this ball-breaking woman, okay? More of a man, basically, than the men in the cabinet. But, okay, so that type does exist, okay? But they're exceedingly, you know, they're quite rare. They're a big outlier. So you can't really make rules based on just Margaret Thatcher. She was a very exceptional individual. For the majority of women, attempting to live as if they were a man leads to unhappiness, sterility of spirit, and cultural distortion. Feminism, in his diagnosis, errs in denying the archetypal differences between men and women, between the masculine and the feminine, and thereby mounting a revolt against reality itself rather than negotiating with it. Now, like I said, we've got 120 years worth of data since Weininger. There are robust studies on, for example, female happiness. This is such an observed phenomenon, this problem of emancipation that we're talking about, that it's got a name. It's called the female happiness paradox. That as feminism has quote unquote progressed, as women have gained more of the roles and responsibilities of men since the 60s and the 70s, they do these huge surveys where they ask women to rate their happiness. And that graph since the, where am I? That graph from the 60s to now goes like that. Like, it is a straight downward line. That as women have become freer, as they have become more, quote unquote, as they've been emancipated or liberated, they have become more unhappy. They have developed more mental health issues, more anxiety, every kind of modern pathology you can think of. They take greater chemical substances, you know, SRIs and things like that in huge numbers now. Depression has skyrocketed. And every other kind of ill that you can think of, suicide attempts have gone through the roof. Even actual successful suicides have increased over the time that we're looking at here. So when women were asked themselves, how happy do you feel? The average woman now, who's got her corporate career, right? She's got her corporate career. She's got her phone with 15 different dating apps on there. Okay, she sees, she might see, this fella on Monday and this fella on Thursday, and she's got another date lined up there. And maybe she'll sleep with four of them. Let's just pretend this is a real woman who exists. She is asked, how happy are you feeling about your life? You know, you've got a good job, you've got a great income, you've got a healthy kind of love life because you're going dating all the time, right? You've got your freedom, you've got your sexual revolution, you've got everything. You've got all of the media pandering to your needs and wants. You've got, Yeah, you've got everything. Everything you've ever asked for. Not happy. Suffering. Mental anxiety. Depression. Etc., etc., etc. Again, on average. Now, obviously, there will be... See, this is where you have to be able to deal with statistics. Obviously, there will be women who existed in the 50s and 60s and 70s and all the way back to Reininger's time, who were desperately unhappy with their situations. But on average, more women said they were happy. And obviously right now, there could be the woman who lives that lifestyle, loves her corporate job, loves her healthy dating app lifestyle. She could absolutely love it. But on average, she's an outlier. On average, more women feel unhappy or say when they're responding to these surveys that they're unhappy. The pure feminine type, according to Otto Weininger, lacks a fully developed transcendental self. Without this, the highest forms of ethical and intellectual life remain structurally inaccessible, owing to metaphysical constitution rather than social deprivation. I'll just get myself out of the way here so you can see what he's talking about. For Weininger, these three capacities form an inseparable triad grounded in the masculine principle. Pure logic, the ability to do pure logic and get yourself out of the way, categorical morality, and what he calls the autonomous self. Now, if some of this stuff sounds familiar to some of you, Weininger was actually very influential on Julius Evola and some of the ideas of capital T traditionalism or perennial traditionalism. I think in Evola's Metaphysics and Eros and the Metaphysics of Love, he draws on some of these categories. Although I should mention that Evola was, how can I put this? Like, he doesn't actually say this. He doesn't go as far as Weininger. Evola says, actually, women are capable of transcendence. They are capable of achieving their higher self. It's just that their methods of getting there are different. He doesn't even say it's impossible to do it, to go the male routes, okay? So the male routes are the hero's journey, or the hero's quest, and the man of pure contemplation, right? So I guess the role of the kind of philosopher or priest or something like that. Two different, the path of action and the path of contemplation. Now, he didn't say it's impossible for women to take those routes, but he said that most women will find themselves unhappy trying to embody those roles. They will just struggle more, find them, because you're trying to fit a square peg into a round hole. So Evola says women will find more success in various devotional paths instead. These come more naturally to women on average, right, than the masculine paths. Okay. Obviously, feminists just go crazy when they hear things like this. Okay. Yet doesn't stop some semblance of that being true. Without this, the highest forms of ethical and intellectual life remain structurally inaccessible. So this is one of the most contested claims in the book, okay, and among the least calmly rebutted. So what is being said here is the one that makes modern feminists just go absolutely nuts. And I would argue that whether they know it or not, unconsciously or subconsciously, this is why there's been such a push to insert women into the role of the traditional hero in many action movies. Okay, I think of Rey Skywalker, for example, in the recent Star Wars films, okay, or I always think of like Arya Stark in Game of Thrones, or there's been many others, of basically putting women in the role of the dashing hero, as opposed to the damsel in distress. Like women, like feminism has always been really against the traditional hero. It's actually topical because a film version of the Odyssey has just come out, right? It's literally Homer's heroism is still causing an issue for modern society. And yet, the fact is, most women, when placed in that role, okay, whether in an actual quest, right, or just in life in general, if they are forced to embody their kind of the masculine paths, it rankles with something, like it doesn't feel harmonious for them, makes them unhappy. They'd rather not, and it just is where it is. And this is one of the key issues of our time, I would say, because it wreaks havoc. It wreaks havoc with relationships and marriages and the dating market, or it just wreaks havoc because you're trying to, again and again, you're trying to fit a square peg into a round hole, and women everywhere are saying, like, I don't really want this. Or even I thought I wanted it, and I just don't. I'd rather not. And so, yeah, this is one of those things that continues to be contested, but it's been talked about all the way back to Weininger's time. Weininger argues that modernity is ever more feminine. The modern culture is increasingly materialistic, increasingly relativistic, focused on the particular and the economic rather than the universal and the spiritual. He diagnoses this as civilizational feminism. In a sense, everybody is becoming a spiritual woman, even the men. The rise of feminism is simultaneously a symptom of this shift and an accelerator of it. An ideological expression of an age, in his view, that lost faith in transcendence. Now, he also talks a little bit. Now, I wouldn't say that homosexuality, in the way that he talks about it, is that relevant to what he was talking about. But he does spend quite a bit of time talking about the intermediate type. That is, what do you do? Like, how do you account for these manly women and these womanly men? Okay. And he says the homosexuality and intermediate sexual types, and you could think these days about, cross dressers or transgender people or, very girly men, right? Or very, very masculine women. These arise from unusual mixtures of masculine and feminine principle, and the natural consequences of humanity's universal bisexual constitution. So he saw these propensities, like there's a potential in every person to embody one or the other, or to be more one or more the other. Okay, so even though he's accused of being a quote-unquote essentialist, this idea of the spectrum was already there in Weininger, okay? He says these are not moral failings. Weininger resists the moralistic condemnation that was so common in his era. These are indeed structural types rather than simple deviances, okay? Although I would say that Weininger has a strong preference for the masculine principle, okay? And there's no point pretending otherwise. And as I said at the start, he may have struggled himself with some of these issues. I think that he identified the woman in himself or the feminine in himself, and he couldn't reconcile it. And this really, this was something when Freud said that clearly this is a deranged individual, this is probably what he was getting at, that he did have a pathology, and he kind of started to hate himself for it. And this is, you know, his thought behind his actual suicide. Cultural hierarchy remains. Nevertheless, the highest cultural and spiritual achievements remain. And in mining a system, this is linked to a strong and stable masculine predominance wherever it occurs. Now, there is a kind of tragedy because he committed suicide. He was willing to die by the truth he believed he had discovered. Weininger's philosophy is ruthlessly consistent, having defined the feminine. And indeed, I mean, one aspect of his thought I have not touched on is that Weininger was Jewish. Okay? He was from a Jewish background. And indeed, we saw he was, I think he lived in Vienna, and there was a big Jewish population there. And so many of the people I mentioned, like Freud and Wittgenstein and Kafka and so on, were kind of moved in those sorts of circles, who were also Jewish, and they recognized his, you know, they said that this guy had, you know, was clearly onto something. But he also said that these feminine traits that he has identified, that his own people, men and women, embodied too much the feminine principle. Okay, and for these sorts of reasons, many people have described Weininger as the classic kind of quote unquote self-hating Jew. Okay, this has added to his controversy over the years, to say the least. You know, and he was saying that this principle lacks the highest value, having detected large elements of both of these things in himself. In his own system, he left him little dignified, okay, left him kind of without a place in the world in his own system. And so, you know, he committed suicide at the age of 23, which obviously, you know, is a tragic thing. But it did massively add to the reception and the success of his book in his own lifetime as well. So that is Otto Weininger, one of the most troubled great thinkers I've looked at, and probably the most controversial as well. But I think that he raises many things that modern society is yet to fully come to terms with and yet to confront. There have been various attempts and various goes. I mean, I remember Steven Pinker wrote a book called The Blank Slate that went into some of these sorts of areas. But it remains the case. It remains the case. I mean, the example I always come up with is that there's this extremely detailed simulation game called Dwarf Fortress. Okay, Dwarf Fortress, where, I mean, the level of detail and obsession that went into making Dwarf Fortress is extraordinary. But it simulates an entire history and culture and a kind of living organic society where people can be assigned individual jobs and careers, and you know, they can do art and they can come up with their own writings and so on. And it's all simulated in this game. Extraordinary, extraordinary game. And I always said, well, look, you know, we've had many, many years now where about 3.5 to 4 billion women all have their own computers. Every single one of them has got a high power computer. Well, many of them do. Many, many, many millions, billions of women have computers. What do they choose to do with those computers? It is an almost perfect natural experiment. How many complex simulations of the type of Dwarf Fortress, that is the work of one or two extremely dedicated and obsessive men, well, how many women have chosen to spend their time doing that? The fact is, it just doesn't appeal. They don't want to make a Dwarf Fortress. And that's fine. I don't have a problem with that. Maybe Dwarf Fortress is not for you. I'm not saying Dwarf Fortress is like the best and the be all. I'm just saying that it's a fact that all of these millions of people with computers, not one of them chose to do that. It's a real-life natural experiment. we can see it's an almost perfect free market. Anybody can make a game now and stick it on Steam. Bedroom coders. Just doesn't really happen. Now, women have made games, and they've made great contributions to gaming, but it has tended to be in the narrative space, writing the story, or coming up with great kind of, there have been games which touch on, but they touch on those kind of personal, emotional things. They're not these kind of grand abstract simulations like the Dwarf Fortress or grand strategy games, of which there are many, but they're almost exclusively made by men and played by men. Almost exclusively. It's almost, and what I'm saying is there's no government making this happen. There's no regulation making this happen. Anybody from almost anywhere in the world can make a game and stick it online now. And yet we see what happens. Now, there are quite a lot of games made by women that are like manga dating simulations. So there have been simulation games written by women, but they're dating sims. Literally kind of, you're dating a manga guy, or you're going for coffee and having a chat or something. Okay. Vininger would just say, of course, men and women are different. Men, more have more of these masculine principles and women have more of these feminine principles. Of course, they're going to reproduce that in the stuff that they make. And this is natural and this is normal and we should celebrate it and we should devise society around this. And many people all around the world can see that and don't have any problem with it. But the official ideology that is pushed in universities and in schools and by governments in the West has a problem with it. They say, well, that's kind of outmoded, that old-fashioned belief. It's kind of outmoded. And yet, this has, I would argue, the greatest and most robust body of evidence for pretty much any topic in human affairs. At this point, it is one of the strongest, and there is so much data to just prove it beyond any doubt. And I would say that this is one of those things in the age of AI, right? Unless they kind of lobotomize all of the AIs, Grok and Claude and what's the other one? ChatGPT and I can't remember. Is one called Opus? I can't remember. There are all of the different AI models. Unless they kind of lobotomize them or force them to lie, I'm struggling to see how, some of these kind of blank slate feminist ideas can really last much longer. Because, I had a good, when I was making this video, I had a little go. I thought, I'm going to have a little play around with the different AI models. There's one called, obviously there's Grok, but there's this thing I've got called, it's called Use AI, right? Now, I don't have an account on there, but I sometimes use it to play with because, what I mean is I don't pay for it, okay? But you can have like a certain, they've got lots of, Sonnet 5, GBT 5.6, Gemini, Fable, Opus, blah, blah. And I basically had a play with them. I had a play with each of them because I knew I was going to do this video. And I said, look, my basic contention is we have 120 years of data in. And, despite his personal kind of idiosyncrasies, more or less that data has proven the core of what he was saying beyond any doubt. For these reasons, I cited a few things like the happiness paradox. And I said, but just do an objective evaluation of one, whether there's actually been a calm, rational rebuttal to anything that Vininger has said in the 120 years since. No, the overwhelming answer, and I tested it with seven different AIs, And two, looking objectively at the data that we have over the past 120 years since binding a rope, is there anything to suggest that the basic tendencies that he was talking about was not true? And overwhelmingly, seven different AI models that I looked at came back with the same answer, that the data is overwhelmingly in one direction, proving based like almost like beyond in any other field, it wouldn't even be an argument. So I would say that the time has long been ripe, basically, for certain, you know, the blank slate was written over 25 years ago now. I think we're long beyond the time where people have kind of had enough of it. It's not even wishful thinking. It is a revolt against a certain type of it's just an inability to accept something that is obviously real to anybody who's just lived in the world. So that is, you know, one of the reasons I think it's worth going back to Weininger, because as controversial as he was and as controversial as he has been, as controversial as this topic is, so many of the issues that we still talk about were prefigured back then, and almost all of the things, all of the talking points and all of the discussions in so many ways hasn't really moved beyond the point of 1902, because it's all still recognizable there. So anyway, I'm going to do all this week, we're doing sex and gender on the Great Thinkers series. I thought I'd start it off with a bang. Weininger, I acknowledge, is a controversial figure, but it's worth knowing about him. It's worth reading him. It's worth trying to take the arguments seriously. And if you have a problem with them, your challenge is to produce a calm, rational, evidenced rebuttal. Calm, rational, evidenced rebuttal. And until you do that, all anybody else will see is frothing at the mouth and emotionalism. Or if you can't win the argument, what else do you do? Oh, shut it down, label, ban. You're still not dealing with the issue. And until you deal with the issue, it will keep on coming back. That's just the way these things work. So, yeah, I would say that in 2026, the time is right to reassess, to reopen the book on all of these things. And I think there's a taste for it. I think there's a society-wide taste to come back at some of these things. Because it's obvious that there's a real issue at the heart of blank slate feminist thinking. Pick up a course at the Academic Agency. Promo code Scorcher gets 25% off. Buy it now. And I'll see you all tomorrow, where we're going to continue in this vein when I look at another really interesting thinker, J.D. Unwin, who was writing about 20 or 30 years after Weininger, another really interesting study. So we'll get on to that then, and I'll see you next time. If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the Academic Agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.